Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Good to be with you, and I think as usual, some of you know me. I'm not going to let you down because I will be controversial and I will make some sweeping statements, and I hope that you will challenge me if you disagree during discussion time. If you really have a burning issue, then feel free to interrupt as we go at the point of discussion, but otherwise please hold till the end because of course I might cover something that arises. For me, the most astonishing thing about this desperate desire for policy and for something substantially and far-reaching new is that we are about to destroy one of South Africa's true post-apartheid miracles, one of the greatest accomplishments in South Africa since 1994. For practical purposes, the industry, the cell phone industry, arose and data, mobile data industry arose at the same time as the new South Africa, roughly 1994. So we have two things born on about the same date, and one of them is such an extraordinary success, if I may say, a success not just for South Africa, but interestingly for the ANC. And instead of claiming it as an astonishing success story, it is actually wanting to destroy it, which is odd indeed. And so we'll look at some of the aspects of it. I regard it as the greatest success of the new South Africa. If anyone knows of a better success, let me know. I can't think of anything that quite beats this. Just bearing in mind before I go on that mobile data and use of mobile technology and telecommunications technology is probably the greatest living standard leveler that there is on earth. This is the one thing that brings rich and poor essentially almost into the same camp, at the same level. It gives poor access to communications and information and storage and data that simply was inconceivable as little as two decades ago. So it is we'll see the extent to which this has happened. It's one of the most astonishing socio-economic phenomena of modern times in the world, and South Africa is one of the best exemplars of that. The number of smartphones in South Africa, there are different data I see around, but according to Stats SA, we're looking at 18 million. 25 million people, it estimates, current expectations, extrapolations, by 2022. Smartphones. So in other words, it's about 40% of the population. We've got the actual number coming up. Internet users, about 27 million. That's not immediately relevant to this discussion. Mobile phones, the coverage is 98% of population, or 73% for LTE, currently best and fastest technology, which is one of the highest in the world, beats some first world countries. It's an amazing accomplishment for South Africa and for the industry and for the ANC and the government for having had a policy that enabled this to happen. And so with that, it's quite interesting that the rhetoric for why this policy is needed is to give wider access, as if somehow you want to do a lot better than 98%. South Africa is 22nd best coverage in the world out of 74 countries that are listed, and there are 200 countries in the world. Most of those that aren't listed are countries that will be below us. In other words, South Africa is virtually in the top 5% of the world's performers. We are one of the best in the world, an incredible success story for South Africa. 52 million are a population, and 66 million active cell phones, that is 128 per 100 people in South Africa. More cell phones, and the number is growing than the number of people. The reason, of course, is that some people have more than one. 41 million users in the population, and data users is 40% of the population, mostly used for social media. So it's interesting that one should be anguishing so desperately about the cost at which people can do Facebooking and tweeting and Twittering and so on. That's the tyranny of the Twittering classes. And then 75% of low-income people, that's people over 15 years of age, that's 120 rand per month average, 75% of the poor have access to mobile data and cell phone technology at an average price of about 120 rand per month. Prepaid is 83%. In other words, the vast majority have prepaid contracts. Postpaid only 17. I was surprised to see that number, which is why I put the source. It did surprise me, but it's, again, amazing good news for South Africa. So what are the objectives of this bill? Well, firstly, everything that was explained at the time of the white paper is pretty much still valid. It's bad policy, bad ideas for the reasons widely dispersed and widely published. With very few exceptions, virtually all tech writers and all tech publications were critical of the core aspects of it. Of course, I think nothing is entirely good or entirely bad, so you want to look at the major elements, the major pillars. And there was pretty much unanimous agreement that the white paper was a bad idea, and we'll see in a moment to what extent it was actually particularly in bad faith, which is a different thing entirely. Its purpose is to implement the white paper as if there's nothing in the white paper or very little of substance ought to be changed, to facilitate service-based competition. In other words, for those unfamiliar with the technology, you have a cable and a tower, and then from there on you want to be able to provide services to local people with mobile cell phones and computers and local Wi-Fi networks and so on. And the idea is to facilitate competition at that level, the last mile, so-called. And it's not entirely clear, I might say, when you read the legislation and the surrounding documents, what many of these terms actually mean. For example, the big one of all, open access, what exactly does that mean? We're going to try and work out if one can make any sense of it. It's very close to actually unintelligible. To eliminate infrastructure duplication. This is an interesting one, the assumption that if you have Vodacom and Cell C and Telkom in Sandton, that this is duplication and you should have only one tower. And as I'm going to say later on, just imagine if we applied this policy to anything else in the economy. You know, we must eliminate retail store duplication and law firm duplication and newspaper and media duplication and broadcasting duplication. You know, why do we have more than one broadcasting tower or service or whatever? So it's a very strange thing to want to eliminate duplication at the same time as you say you want competition. That is, in fact, what competition is. It's a contradiction in terms, to create a monopoly and then say you're creating a monopoly in order to have competition. Of course, the argument would be you want a monopoly in order to have competition at a different level in the hierarchy. But it is still, again, an obvious contradiction. And then to promote transformation. This is a nice catchphrase. The word transformation nowadays justifies just about anything. And when you actually work out what radical economic transformation means in the rhetoric, and I've done this recently for a different purpose, look up what Zuma and Ramaphosa and various ministers of trade and industry and finance, what they all say, it means there's actually very little that you get on race. It's all about implementing all the things that have been adopted in the past. going all the way back to Gear, according to Rob Davies, and IPAP and other stuff. So what is transformation? It's a nice thing. It's a motherhood thing. Nobody can be against it, so you want to have transformation. I'm going to look at that in a little bit more detail in a moment. And then the ultimate beneficiaries, according to the memorandum that was circulated by the department, would be consumers. And it's interesting that this would be over time, at some unknown distant future date, they will supposedly have beneficiaries in the sense that there will be wider choice. They will supposedly get more choices, and the answer is at retail level, having created monopolies at wholesale level or infrastructure level, and then there will be cheaper prices or cheaper services. This is said to be so. There's no real explanation as to why this ought to be so. There is a socio-economic impact assessment in which that sort of thing is meant to be explained. What is the mechanism by which you would expect more choices and lower prices? This is nowhere to be found that I could find. Why would this be the consequence? Weber Wenzel, one of the law firms that specializes in the IT field, published a description of it and said the purpose of it is to create a centralized authority, as they call it, to provide wholesale services on an open access basis to other persons. In other words, what this is to say, it's like the distribution depot of Macro will have to provide services to Woolworths, for example, to distribute in Woolworths products to the stores, and so this is a kind of odd thing where people have to provide services to their competitors. This is what will be required. So just to get that clear, what is proposed is that on the same terms, Vodacom has the right to use Cell C towers. Cell C can't stop them, as is proposed. It doesn't say on what terms. It's meant to be cost-based, whatever that means, and we have someone in the back there who's a highly qualified accountant and knows about these things. You can't work out what the cost is of one tower or 1 megabyte of data being transmitted anywhere. That's not how costs work. Costs include the entire cost of the operation is included. It can't be broken down in economics or accounting terms down to a very specific amount that you can then say that's the cost. But anyway, whatever it is that some bureaucrat one day says is the cost of a given megabyte of data, that cost will be open to everyone. In other words, Cell C on its tower will have to offer at the same price to everyone the use of its tower. And the result of that, of course, is that it in turn will be able to use everyone else's tower. And the result of that, you don't have to be very clever to predict, is that nobody will build any more towers. Nobody will build any more infrastructure. That's obvious. It's kind of would be a very strange world to see a new tower go up after this act becomes law. It will be odd indeed. And if you see one, please let me know. I would like to go and ask the company concerned why on earth they're building another tower. It would be a very silly thing to do. The process is very concerning to me. And I want to delve into this a bit more than maybe the tech people and the media people have done. Firstly, the law requires in South Africa bona fide public participation under Section 195 of the Constitution. By bona fide is meant that the public participation must inform the policy. You can't just go through the motions. You can't decide what you want to do, have participation, and then carry on with what you wanted to do regardless of what is put forward in the participation. The participation needs to be an integral part of forming the policy, not of simply saying afterwards we went through the motions. That was not done here. On the contrary, there was lots of participation, but what ended up in the white paper was some very substantial stuff that was never in the participation, like the wireless open access network. So that the white paper basically ignored public participation and adopted a whole lot of stuff that was never discussed or the subject of participation. Then it is required, not in law, but by the cabinet, a cabinet resolution, that there must always, for all new laws and policies, be a socio-economic impact assessment. Well, there wasn't one. And we in the Free Market Foundation agitated and agitated and said, where is it, where is it, where is it? And then once I was on a TV program with the minister and I said there's no socioeconomic impact assessment, they kept saying there is one, but it was never seen or released, nobody knew about it. And then he made me look silly by saying, Mr. Lowe doesn't know what he's talking about, it's on the website. So I went and looked at the website, and lo and behold, that night, just before the program, it was put on the website. Now, you can make your own decision as to whether that was a deliberate, malicious way of making it appear as if I hadn't done my homework to go and put a socioeconomic impact assessment there the night before a debate, and then to say, well, it's on the website, what on earth is he talking about? And so you can now go and look at it. And if you go to the website, you'll find where the documents are. It's quite hard to find. It happens to be the very last one right at the bottom of a long list. And if you open it, you will see that it's a very phony socioeconomic impact assessment. It doesn't meet any of the requirements that are specified in the guidelines issued by the presidency and now implemented, supposedly, but apparently not in this case, by the Department of Planning's Socioeconomic Impact Assessment Unit. So whether they've approved it or passed it is unclear. You can't find that out. There's no public information to that effect. But nonetheless, it would be very strange if they did approve it because it is conspicuously lacking in compliance with the requirements of the presidency's guidelines for how to do socioeconomic impact assessments. Then the Constitution requires rationality, and there are all sorts of elements in it which could be debated as to whether they are rational as defined by the Constitutional Court for constitutional purposes for the rule of law requirement of Section 1 of the Constitution. But I think we could expect lots of litigation if this bill is passed and if there's an attempt to implement it, and that litigation will no doubt invoke, for example, the rationality clause. Others, like the property rights clause, will obviously be invoked. The requirement that there be fair and reasonable administrative action will be invoked, and other constitutional provisions will become a long process mired in legislation and litigation that will delay not just the implementation of the policy or prevent the implementation of the policy, but more importantly will put South Africa's technological progress, one of the most spectacular success stories in the world, on hold. We will go into a system of death, of stasis. We will fall asleep and become moribund while the rest of the world moves on to 5G and, you know, maybe satellite and other more advanced technologies. We will stop this amazing success story which we've achieved. This belated non-socioeconomic impact assessment, for example, one of the requirements is you have to say what the mischief is. What is it that you want to fix? Called in law the mischief principle. Why do you want a law? You want a law to change something you think isn't good enough. It's not entirely clear what it says. For example, the 1996 white paper, it says it's to implement, that has not been implemented, and therefore we need a new bill to see that it is implemented. Now, I would like to remind some of you that there was no cell phone network or technology then, and what that white paper was about was putting in landlines. It was about Telkom servicing homes with landlines, wanting millions of them, and the number has, of course, tumbled because they ceased to be important. So the white paper became an embarrassing, irrelevant thing, showing that the planners had no idea what the future held. And so one of the things we supposedly are now going to do is implement that, which is to put in landlines to tribal villages, for example, where they all have cell phones and where there's 98% population coverage. Then there was this weird thing of Minister Tshwele, if I can remind you, those of you forgotten, that he came back from Mexico and said he saw it working there and it was a great success and prices were down and so on. Now, whether he'd been misinformed or whether it was a calculated misrepresentation, anybody's guess, I don't know. But it was simply nonsense. It was nonsense on steroids. There was no such thing. There was a policy under discussion. It had not been implemented, and it still hasn't. It's now in the process of being implemented, one of two countries in the world. And so there was this strange, weird claim of having seen it operating. in Mexico where there was no such thing. So what was he saying that for, and where did he get that information, and was it, or did he assume no one would check it out? Unfortunately, we are intellectual detectives, and we sniff away at this stuff and found out that it was just nonsense. Then the world's only WOAN of the kind we are promoting in South Africa, the centralized authority to run all mobile networks, the only place that has actually tried it is Rwanda, and in Rwanda it is a complete disaster. And so there's one case in the world, a tiny little landlocked, rapidly progressing and growing, I mean a great country, Rwanda, what they've been doing, but relative to us, a fairly backward place, relative to the world, a fairly backward and inconspicuous and almost irrelevant place. We are now copying what it has done, and it's the only place in the world we can copy. And what has it done? Well, it's got higher prices. The prices have risen for LTE, which is theirs, by the way, confined to LTE. They don't do 3G or 4G or 2G. And 30% coverage versus the 96 that was promised. In other words, it was meant to achieve roughly what we have. And in fact, all they have got so far is 30%, a third of what was promised. Only 25,000 people, 25,000 smartphone users with LTE in Rwanda, and this is the policy we want to follow, where we have, 40 million South Africans and something like, what is it, we're looking at about 30 million South Africans with LTE. So 25,000 people versus 8 million outside the WOAN, which is the extent to which they continue to do things normally. This is the story we want to replicate. Now, I don't understand this. It's actually weird to me. I keep saying, who's on the take? Who's benefiting? Why is this being done? It really makes no sense. Nothing you look at makes any sense in this at all. Why it's wanted. GSMA said that Rwanda is a significant, was the word, failure. And then there's the issue in the part of, as far as dubious process is concerned, of the public engagement. It is said there was public engagement. Now, there have been lots of public meetings and calls for submissions and lots of submissions. I attended one of those. And it had no engagement whatsoever. I attended the one in Pretoria. The minister and the DG were there. Speakers and the service providers, network operators were there, and some of the people in this room were there. And what it basically was, it was a briefing session telling people what's going to be done and saying there was no discussion of policy allowed whatsoever. All that could be discussed was implementation. A very small amount of time, I think half an hour, maybe an hour at most, was allowed to the industry. Everyone thinks the industry is one thing. I'm going to get to that in a moment. The industry, is the favorite cliche in South Africa. Industry must come to the table. Who the hell are they talking about? Where is this entity called industry? Does it meet in Sherwood Forest at midnight and conspire to be one actual thing and make it look as if they're competitors by day? And so anyway, they... This engagement was completely farcical in my view, quite obviously farcical. And then when I said that on this TV debate that there was no proper engagement, I was told, oh, but you were even there, Mr. Lowe. How could you say that there was no engagement? Well, I could say there was no engagement because I was there. That's the basis on which I was able to say there was no engagement. And apart from which, there has been no engagement on the policy. The policy was never discussed, never debated, was never agreed to by the expert panel that was put together, 22 people. And so all that has been allowed to engage on is how to implement the policy. That is not how policy is formed, and that is not engagement on policy. Then on the question of high data charges, so-called, there's an assumption that data charges are high in South Africa. Now, I suppose many or most people in this room assume that's true, that somehow, somewhere, someone found that South Africa's data, mobile data is more expensive than elsewhere and is excessively, we have high data charges or costs. government believes false news. It really thinks it's true. And in the portfolio committee, this four-country meme, I've just put in three of the four, but for the lower priced ones, they were saying India has 11 rand, Nigeria 22, Namibia 32, where we have 150 rand for a gigabyte of mobile data. Well, that was simply the nonsense. The source of that meme, that four-country thing, which still floats around, you go to the Data Must Fall Twitter thing, and you'll still see it there. It's still rolled out. It came, one person, we know him, he's a good friend of ours, and he laments what he did and has tried to pull it back and couldn't once the cat's out of the bag, so I'm not going to name him, but he's a very fine person of the highest integrity. He'd gone to one website, Ookla, those are the ones you'll be familiar with testing your speed. It's the website where you test your data speed, your connection speed. And there was this table there, which he assumed was correct. He took it down and he published these prices, India 11, Nigeria 22. And when he went back to have another look at the table, it was gone. It appeared and disappeared. And nobody knows, nobody can tell where it came from or who produced it, and it's gone. We pointed that out to various people, like, for example, Thibaut Touch and Gareth Cliff, and they immediately stopped beating that drum. They were the ones who popularized it. They also couldn't pull it back. It was too late. It had become popular mythology. And so what is really the truth of the matter is something quite different. The Indian one, just by way of example, we investigated, turned out to be one small loss leader promotion in one city, one small place in India that came and went as a promotion. And this then was paraded as if it's the price of a gigabyte of mobile data in India. There is no such thing as the price of a gigabyte of mobile data in India, by the way. It's an extreme federation, huge variations from place to place. There is no way to calculate it. In other words, if I said to one of you bright people in this room, I said to, you know, Mike over there, you're a top econometrician, go away and calculate the price of a data of a gig for me in India, he would come back after about 6 months and say, look, I'm sorry, it's not possible. Can't be done for all sorts of reasons that actually ought to be obvious. The reality is somewhat different. It is impossible to say what a gig costs in South Africa, for example. What is the price of 1 gig of mobile data in South Africa? There is no such single thing. You can try and come up with some kind of average. You would have to have access to information from the data providers, which you can't have, and they won't share, and they don't even probably know themselves. They can't work out their own average cost of a gig. But certainly to have cross-country comparisons is totally and completely out of the question. The International Telecommunications Agency tries to, and it explains its methodology and points out that the methodology is highly speculative and not econometrically sound, or accurate, let's say. You try to compare like with like. It's very difficult because what's for sale in one country is not the same thing as what's for sale in another country. So a direct comparison is close to impossible. Prices are falling in South Africa anyway due to economic factors, tech improvements, competition in South Africa. And as for India supposedly being the world's cheapest at 11 rand per gig, I personally, right now, have a contract lasting with, it doesn't, you know, everyone says the data expires. I have right now, in this phone, data that costs 8 rand a gig and lasts a year, 1 year. So now, is that the price of a gig of data in South Africa? And if anyone doesn't believe me, I'll show you. What you get, you see. If you compare what I actually have, I've purchased it. I've got 1 year of data at 8 rand a gig right now. So why did they not put South Africa in at 8 rand? Why at 150 rand, which is the cost if you exceed your contract for some companies, which is, again, a very specific price of data, in fact, the highest price of data. So you take the highest price of data in South Africa, you compare it to the lowest price of data somewhere else, and then you say South Africa's overcharging. Well, that's just not true. If you take the lowest price of data in South Africa that I'm aware of is 8 rand, maybe you can get it cheaper that I just don't know because I'm not a good shopper. And then South Africa's prices, we did the international comparisons. We have the data. Unfortunately, the data has not been released or made public, as far as I know. But South Africa, compared to its peers, is pretty much average. We are similar to peer countries, countries like Brazil and India and Russia and so on. Our data prices are similar to the extent. All you can really do is look at tables and offers and get a feeling. I mean, that's really the only way you can tell. You might be able to do some very elaborate calculations, but basically our prices are very conspicuously similar to what they are in peer countries. Other aspects of the dubious process, now the bill has been published and there are 30 days for comment over the Christmas holidays. Now, when we got hold of, for example, the opposition representatives on IT in some of two of the parties, they didn't even know that a bill had been published. They should have been aware, but they didn't. 30 days. Now, is that in good faith? Do you expect something that has very far-reaching implications? I mean, this is big. This is seriously big stuff. You know, this isn't the new parking bylaws of Paris. This is one of the most important issues in the country that affects every person in the country, and you allow 30 days for studying and considering something that complicated, and bearing in mind you're not asked to consider, which is wrong in law, when a bill is published, the public are invited to debate the bill. But what they're saying is you're not allowed even to comment on the bill, you're allowed to comment on how to implement it. Now, that's even more complicated. It takes you longer to discuss implementation than to discuss its substance. Then the industry, as usual, has been shafted by bad faith negotiations. And I want to say as usual because we in the Free Market Foundation have witnessed this over and over again. The mining industry meets in a Bosberaad behind closed doors with the ministry about the expropriation of mineral rights, and they come away and they tell us a deal has been reached. Therefore, we, the Free Market Foundation, should stop bothering to oppose the measure. The same happened with water, the same happened now with mobile data. Literally, we were told, healthcare. We were told, don't worry, a deal's been reached, everything's going to be fine, there's going to be a hybrid, the discussions have taken place secretly by the operators' forum, which is the closest thing the industry got to being one thing, although the people in the forum completely disagreed with each other about almost everything of substance. But nonetheless, they were led to believe that this was going to go back to the cabinet for a revision of the white paper and that there was going to be a hybrid, and this was the word floating around, and industry believes there's a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a belief that they were misled and cheated and lied to. None of us know what happened behind closed doors. We don't know. I don't know. All I can do is say that I am told by people who were there that what has happened is that they were double-crossed or misled or lulled into a sense of security that the original white paper would not be implemented as envisaged. Then there's this lots of dangerous rhetoric about rhetoric. Business is not coming to the table is a favorite phrase, which whenever you hear it, I want you to, take off your shoe and hit the person next to you on the head or something. But it's just a ridiculous statement. Business isn't one entity. Business doesn't do anything as an entity ever. We have this strange policy that on the one hand we want businesses to compete and not collude, and then we want businesses to act as one entity. Business must suddenly do one thing and have one view. There's a lot of confusion. Business never goes to the table, at least not of government. It goes to the consumer table. That's what business does. It finds out what consumers want, and that's how data works. Is they make offers, and one of the things I'm not allowed to disclose a piece of information we're given because it's trade secrets and market stuff, but one of the most popular pieces of data is data that costs a lot more than 150 Rand per gig if you add it up, but it lasts for one day, and it's a few megabytes. That's what people want in rural villages to send in their university assignment. So now what they're being told is you have to give them that data that must be valid for 3 years. So how much is that going to cost? That's what the bill says. It has to last for 3 years. So data that now can be sold and they just want to send in their assignment and it's very cheap. Well, it's very cheap for a megabyte, but if you multiply that into a gig, it's very expensive. That is what consumers want. That's revealed preference, as economists call it, of consumer need and demand. So now we have a bundle of bureaucrats who think they know better than consumers what consumers want. They think they know better than consumers what they ought to be buying and at what price and what they should desire. So business must be told not to collude, and yet it must speak with one voice. Business is not an entity. It's a complex, cross-cutting, competitive set of interests. And even when businesses collude, businesses that collude are competing interests. It's quite difficult for people to get their brain around this, that often collusion is itself a competitive strategy, either to compete against people who are not in the collusion or to actually shaft your colluder. In other words, you get them to agree to something that's going to give you a competitive advantage over them. So this notion that collusion is some kind of happy, harmonious meeting of competitors' minds is also simply wrong. So if we then look at the question of my concern, which you see I've got to, economic illiteracy, there's almost no understanding in the discourse relating to this bill or the white paper about how markets work and what markets are. It's a kind of level of economic illiteracy that's quite hard to grasp. And someone like Mike Schussler is in the audience, one of our top economists in the country. I don't know how much of this is read and followed, but I think he must, I can't imagine what this does to his putting. It must be at a low point in his life, having to read this level of, frankly, economic illiteracy. There's no better word for it. Competition theory, for example, the idea that there should be competition. It starts off with me having pointed out that they want competition by creating a monopoly. This is an odd way to create competition, but that's what is proposed in the act, in the bill. One of the things that's most difficult to understand is people think competition is amongst people who supply the same product or service. In other words, the competitor for someone who sells shoes is someone else who sells shoes. This is a completely false notion of competition. Competition is amongst all people who want your rands. People who sell toothpicks compete with people who sell holiday packages, and they compete with Uber, and they compete with Woolworths, and everyone who wants your rand is in competition with each other. They all have to persuade you to part with your rand to them instead of someone else. It's what we might call rand competition. And then as to people selling the same product or service, there's a notion that you should compete but not win. So, for example, when two network providers who were a government-created duopoly initially, then two more were allowed in, and now another two more, we now have six, allowed in, instead of just opening the market, which is what you would think you would do if you want competition, but nonetheless, then they don't like the fact that one of them or two of them become big. This is somehow wrong. You mustn't win the competition. You've got to compete, but whatever you do, if you win, then you've got too much market dominance and you're suspicious. So you've got to compete and lose. This is like asking people, well, it's like the South African rugby team, I suppose. They have that policy. Compete, but don't win. Sorry?
So does the soccer team, yes.
Maybe this is some kind of national character. I don't know how the Blitzbucker escaped this psychology, but we in South Africa believe compete, but whatever you do, don't win. Compete and lose. Then you're somehow a hero. Then you're good. That is supposedly virtuous. What competitors want to do is attract consumers from rivals, regardless of whether they collude. And this is an important thing to understand. Even if you collude, you are still feverishly, desperately trying to get consumers from your competitors. And a collusion floats around in the air. Nobody has actually laid any charges or found any evidence of collusion, but people assume there's collusion because there's a duopoly. And you strive for revealed demand. You want to get what consumers actually want. You respond. That's what they do. That's how they operate. And I've actually sat in a room with one of the service providers when a message came through about a new offering from a competitor. And they sat there and said, well, why don't we offer this instead? Nobody did any fancy calculations. They just thought they better bring out something that competed with it. And that's how these decisions are made. You test the water. You don't have any great technology to decide how to compete. And then you search for trade-offs. Now, this is important. Under this bill, there is no appreciation whatsoever for how capital is formed, how investment is made, how profits are made, how wealth is accumulated, how consumers are serviced. So what you do in the competitive marketplace is you seek to find the right trade-off between consuming profit by paying dividends or spending it on yourself, saving, investing, capital formation, buying new technology, doing research, advertising, marketing, selling the product. There is a very complex mixture of things you have to try to balance and trade-offs when you're in business. This bill understands none of that. And then if I can just mention, for those of you interested in behavioral economics, to the extent that it is valid, it's simply a tool in the hands of the competitors. Moving on, there's this open access idea. Now, open access is a competitive option. Everyone's free to give open access. There's nothing stopping anyone, and some do. Some have wholesale buyers of data, and there are retailers who buy wholesale. It's perfectly fine. That is a competitive strategy. If it's a good idea, there's no reason why one of the six shouldn't engage in it or engage in it more than they presently do. You don't need a government policy or a legislation to bring that about. Then I want to make this point. There is a view that concentration is bad, that a few operators, a duopoly or I don't know what you'd call six operators, is that a... It sounds kind of naughty, doesn't it? A sexopoly. Or sextopoly, or I don't know what. But anyway, the two operators, there's a view that if there are few, that some are bad. Well, this is quite wrong. That's not how competition works. Competition exists when a market is contestable. Now, for example, if there were one supplier of motor cars in South Africa, only Ford or Toyota or somebody, provided you and I are absolutely free to import any car we wish at any time into South Africa, fairly small, little, ordinary folk could compete with the world's most substantial conglomerates immediately and easily. All that you've got is the ability to enter. And any market you think is dominated by a few operators, then I would say to you, if they are abusing that, then you have to explain to me why no one else has entered. And you don't have to be big to enter, but bearing in mind, big ones can enter. There are always very big, giant conglomerates out there ready to enter. And if they don't, you have to ask, why not? Either because it's not profitable, because the market is efficient, or because there's a regulatory entry barrier, which is what this bill wants to create. So what the WOAN would do is eliminate contestability. It has in mind that nobody else will be able to buy any more spectrum and enter the market. Existing spectrum, it seems, it's not entirely clear to me, will be held by those who have it, and all unallocated spectrum, which is actually a scandal in South Africa that there's so much, will go to this WOAN, this Wireless Open Access Network, and that it will be uncontestable. No one else will be able to enter the market against it. So we would monopolize infrastructure. Imagine the same for others, told we must get rid of duplication. Imagine retailers being told they shouldn't have duplicity. We shouldn't have two retail stores in your neighborhood. This is needless and wasteful duplication. Or newspapers shouldn't have, you know, two press offices and printing services, broadcasters. You know, imagine banks, publishers, auto dealers. You know, this idea that you don't duplicate infrastructure is very weird. And it fascinates me that in this field, nobody laughs. Nobody says, how crazy is that? It's like nuts to say you don't want to duplicate infrastructure. You don't say, if you said it in any other context, it would be manifestly laughable. But for some reason in this context, you can get away with saying something laughable if you said that in any other context. And there's a weird assumption that they make in the bill, which says that if there's adequately serviced place, pofada is adequately serviced, no one else may come and build a tower there or put infrastructure there. In other words, there's a forced monopoly. But who already has a tower is obliged to let everyone have equal access to that tower. The assumption being that if you stop somebody building a second tower in Pofada, that they will go and build the second tower somewhere else, in Anslet, or Vergenoeg, or somewhere. Well, no, that is not how it works. If you say you may not build a second tower in Pofada, you just don't have another tower in South Africa. That is what happens. You don't get that same tower somewhere else. You don't stop building something in A and it pops up magically in B instead. That's not how things work. So the bill is based on assumptions that are truly weird. It's kind of very strange stuff. Webber Wenzel points out that where an area is adequately serviced, and I quote from them, no further electronic communications networks or facilities, I presume that even includes a local Wi-Fi, may be deployed in that area except with the approval of ICASA. How they would make that decision is not clear, but nonetheless, essentially it creates a monopoly where there is an existing tower. Now, can you imagine that? Can you imagine saying, you happen to have a tower, no one else may come and build another tower to compete with you? This is a strange policy. Why would you want such a policy is the odd thing about it, other than a profound economic illiteracy and misconception about how economics works. Then there's this view that data must not expire for 3 years. Now, think about this. There's no such thing as a free lunch. If you buy data that expires every month, as far as I can tell, about 25%, or maybe you can tell me if I've got the number wrong, but about 25% goes unused on average. I think that's about right, maybe 30%. So if you say that the data may not expire, then what you do is you reduce the right of consumers to buy expiring data and you force them to pay what the price would be of non-expiring data. Does anyone know what it would cost and how much more it would cost to have non-expiring data? It's not clear, by the way, the term in the bill is completely ambiguous. I defy anybody here to tell me whether it says you must provide 3 year expiring data as well as whatever else you expire. In other words, included in your offering must be 3 year data, but you can continue with 1 day data or 24 hour data or whatever it might be. It's not clear whether the law refers to additional or exclusive data. Or 3 years is additional or is exclusive. Then there's, as I said, revealed consumer preference, and the only way you can know what consumers want and what to sell is through the market. Test the market, see what people in fact buy. Then I want to make this point. Somehow, again, in the field of data, there's an assumption that data expiring is somehow wrong. A shelf life for data is somehow a bad thing. Nobody that I'm aware of has said the same about other areas. Other areas also have expiring claims. If your insurance claim, if you don't claim in your insurance within 6 months or something, your claim expires. Air miles expire. Mine seem to always expire before I get to use them. Loyalty rewards for shopping rewards. I don't know, what's this thing that FNB has? It's e-bucks or whatever they are, yeah, expire. Warranties expire. You buy something, then you have an expiring warranty. Now, you could say the warranty must never expire. Well, you can have a law that says that. It'll just mean everything costs more. If you buy non-expiring stuff, you pay more. Now, do you want the poor to pay more? The rich people in this room actually probably wouldn't even know the difference between the price of expiring and non-expiring stuff, whether it's air miles or e-bucks or whatever else. But for the poor, this can be devastating. It can price data out of their market completely by not allowing it to expire. And food has sell-by dates. Now, you might say, but that's different. But the point is that can you imagine saying Woolworths has to stop selling expiring food so that you keep it on your shelf for a month and the tomatoes get rotten and you take them back and say, my tomatoes expired, and then they have to replace them. Or you could say that the sell-by date may not be shorter than some period. Well, if, for example, you buy something with a milk or whatever with a sell-by date of a week, a month, whatever it is, you can have a law that says it has to have a longer sell-by date. Well, you're just going to make it more expensive. Simple, not very complicated, not rocket science. And then there's the thing of transformation. Now, this is interesting. It is very clear, in my view, that the white paper and this bill have in mind the enrichment of a few anointed elites, a few select people that will be beneficiaries, and maybe a few rich people, maybe a few big companies, but certainly some individuals who are probably not that hard to identify for people in the field, and the masses will be the victims. This is another one of the things of transferring wealth from the poor to the rich, and the poor will be denied choices and a range of products and competing companies with competing prices, and the one that wins is the one consumers vote for with their rands. Just let's understand how anti-investment this is. The last 3 years have seen 10 billion rands of investment per annum in the infrastructure. What is going to happen after they are told that they may recover only cost, no profit? Can you expect any further investment? Can you expect another 10 billion rand per annum to be invested by the mobile operators, of which there are now six? And then you have this cost-based approach. Now, that guarantees stagnation, guarantees or cheating. People will just lie about what their costs are. And it's easy. Are you not going to be... Ayanda sitting over there will come up with accounting that will dazzle any bureaucrat as to what the real cost was of a given piece of technology or providing a tower in some remote village or whatever it might be. There's no way that bureaucrats will be able to second guess or improve on what is done. You might require very costly audits perhaps. But nonetheless, the cost-based approach will guarantee no further investment whatsoever. If you want South Africa's miracle of post-apartheid miracle of telecommunications to come to a sticky end or to crash, this bill will do that. This bill will achieve it. And then there's a need for a dynamic and rapid use of cutting-edge technology. Let's just understand that. 5G is around the corner. The Internet of Everything is upon us. I think one of the companies is already providing an app for the so-called Internet of Everything. That's not quite the Internet of Everything yet. But certainly within a few years, everything about you will be the subject of mobile data. Your clothes will measure your exercise levels and your blood pressure, and your cars will tell you when you're passing a shop that's selling a thing that you need that your fridge has run out of, and so on. So the Internet of Everything is an astounding phenomenon that is about to happen. Mobile data is going to be very important. But more importantly, being up with technology almost by the day is going to be absolutely critical, and you certainly don't want to bog us down in red tape, litigation, and state-created, if not state-run, monopolies. On that, by the way, it is said that the WOAN will not be government-owned. It's not even quite clear who will, in fact, own it, but it will certainly be government-run. That's clear, and it'll be a government-run monopoly. The one in Rwanda, by the way, is 51% Chinese and 49% the Rwandan government. So it is, they can say in Rwanda it's not government-owned because it's 51% Chinese, which is foreign-owned. And are we going to do something like this in South Africa? We don't know. So then, interestingly, the NDP, the National Development Plan, which we told is our policy, has service-based and infrastructure competition, competition that should be, that's autocorrect, built into it and is just simply ignored. Then there's this, what I call the spectrum scandal, this absolutely outrageous failure to allocate spectrum. Now, I could go, and some of you better than me, go into the technological impact of that, which is refarming of towers, for example, where I go occasionally, a little town called Wakkerstroom. There's one tower there which all the operators use, and they have some deal, so there's obviously open access, at least for their competitors. So I can have my 8 Rand deal with this one operator, and I access it through another operator's tower. And my home-based one is a local Wi-Fi, which comes from Jenny. So little dorp, everything works very well, and the prices are all pretty low and competitive. So now we have the spectrum, which means that if you have a tower and you had enough spectrum, you could operate everything through it, old 2G phones, 3G, LTE, and in due course, 5G. Because of the failure to allocate spectrum and to have digital migration from SABC's wasteful TV use of spectrum, we have a shortage of spectrum. And that means that extra towers have to be built everywhere because one tower isn't allowed to use all the technology that it could use and economize. So what we have is this unallocated high-demand spectrum, which has unreasonably throttled the industry, forced wasteful investment in capital, forced artificially high prices. That is now all going to go into this new state-run monopoly. Whoever owns it is not clear, but it'll be state-run. Why wasn't it allocated, and why isn't it auctioned? And the best way to deal with it is actually to have a market process. For those of you who don't know, again, Mike Schüssler will know the Coase theorem. The Coase theorem is a marvelous piece of economics for which he got the Nobel Prize, which basically says it doesn't really matter how you allocate resources to start with, as long as there's a market, as long as the resources are freely tradable after allocation, they will gravitate into the most efficient and optimal hands. And so that's the way you do it, is you allocate the spectrum by auctioning it or long-term contracts, whatever, and then you say people are free to trade it, and then it will trade into the person who's going to use it most effectively and competitively's hand, according to the Coase theorem, which, as far as I know, is not seriously debated amongst economists as a legitimate theory or rule of economics. So in summary then, as I reach my conclusion, the bill is truly weird, and I say truly weird, it is weird. It's on the table, so we take it seriously. But if it weren't on the table and somebody suggested it, you would say, that's really weird. Why would you want to uproot, destroy, eliminate one of South Africa's most astonishing success stories? In fact, the greatest success story of the new South Africa. So it's weird, and there's lots else that's weird, the economic illiteracy that informs it, the use of false and factual information on a vast scale. Then it's not consumer-centric. It ignores consumers. It presupposes that what consumers want to buy is irrelevant, that somehow people on high know better than consumers what they ought to be buying, and so there will be a planned and imposed order by people who know nothing about business or consumption. Well, they know about consumption their own, but not about consumption in the economic sense. It's not pro-poor. In that, if you, for example, say data has to last for 3 years, that means what the poor now buy and what the poor now want will not be available to them. They will be forced to buy expensive, non-expiring data. It will destroy the ANC's greatest achievement, and I want to make a party political statement here. I do not understand why the ANC, especially in the run-up to elections, isn't trumpeting this as one of its great success stories. It's a strange strategy, actually, for the ANC to effectively say it has been a failure, therefore you must vote for it, and it will be a success when it implements the failure in a radical way. So radical economic transformation is a sort of radical economic failure, because Well, I don't think it's failed, interestingly. I think it's actually been remarkably successful. And I don't know why they don't employ me as their propagandist, because I think I would do a much better job. You don't win an election by going around to people saying, we have failed, therefore you should vote for us, which is essentially what the policy is on this, as a number of other things. And then there are factually false assumptions being made, and this is unforgivable because we and others have made the facts available. We've submitted them. We've pointed out the factual errors, non-contestable factual errors that continue to be recycled over and over again as if they were true. Then there's this dodgy participation claims, participation which simply didn't really happen, and then the anointed elites will benefit at the expense of the poor and others, and then there are elements that are probably unconstitutional, and we will be mired in litigation, I'm sure, if this goes ahead as it is, because of the various powerful vested interests that will be harmed, and there will be challenges on the lack of bona fide participation, for example, a violation of Section 195, the lack of using objective criteria for discretionary powers, Section 1, the rule of law, and various other provisions. That gets me to the end, and I thank you for your attention, and I hope that, if nothing else, I've made somebody angry or somebody pleased. But if you're sitting there thinking you just agreed with everything I said, then I and you have achieved nothing, if you're in the same position you were before. So hopefully that was of some value.